Welcome to the Film Experience Podcast. Thank you for your patience. It's taken us a long time to deliver the SmackDown of 2001. And now I'm here with my special guest, Shane Slater.
I'm Shane. I write for WordCircuit.com, mostly covering foreign language films, documentaries, and the occasional film festival.
And then we also have another first-time SmackDowner, Valerie Complex.
I am a freelance entertainment journalist. I have a specialty in film criticism, and my work is kind of all over the place. I wish I had a steady place that I could write, but a lot of my stuff is at the Playlist. I have a couple of things at the Mary Sue. I've written for The Hollywood Reporter, Harper's Bazaar. And when I'm not moonlighting as a broke writer, I am actually an IT professional.
Thank you for joining us, Valerie. And then we have Joe Reed, who's a semi-regular on the SmackDown.
Hello. I write about TV full-time, sort of full-time, at primetimer.com. And I have a podcast called This Had Oscar Buzz.
And then we have, if you've read the written portion of the SmackDown by the time you're listening to this, we also have Eric Anderson from Awards Watch. And he is unfortunately having Skype trouble this morning, so he might join us in progress. So I had not seen any of these movies for a very, very long time.
Same.
Even the ones that I loved originally. In the Bedroom in Gosford Park, I was a huge fan of at the time. And my very first reaction upon watching them all again was something I don't usually experience during the SmackDowns, because we usually go for earlier years where everybody was already dead. Or
right.
Before my lifetime, but the whole time I was like, oh, everyone is so young, this means I'm 20 years older.
Even the actresses who were old at the time.
Yes.
Seem so young. Like, I'm looking at Maggie Smith and I'm just like, she's so fresh-faced and young. And it's like, but it's kind of true. You're so used to seeing her on like Downton Abbey and Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and all these sort of like movies that happen so much later.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wow, 2001 was a good bit ago, wasn't it?
A long time ago. I graduated high school in 2001. So when I look back at it, I'm like, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, man.
And Valerie, had you seen these at the time when you were fresh out of
no,
high school?
I saw them when I was in the military. I was overseas and, you know, you just get bored and you just start looking for stuff. And, you know, at the time I was tracking, like, you know, Oscar stuff, because that was, film was my thing, has always been. So this was like around 2010 that I discovered, because I was on a Judi Dench binge.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw Iris. I saw Gosford Park, on television, I was living in Germany, so I saw it on TV. In the Bedroom, because somebody else recommended it. And A Beautiful Mind, I had been skipping for a while because I'm not a huge Russell Crowe fan, but, you know, I ended up seeing them all relatively within the same year. And while, you know, rewatching them was weird because, you know, Iris didn't hold up as well, and in the Bedroom was kind of like, what the heck? So it was, you know, it just was a different vibe back then, and then watching it recently was interesting. I don't usually change my mind about films once I have an opinion, but I did this time around.
Mm-hmm. I kind of felt differently about all four of the films, which surprised me. How about you, Joe? Did they feel different to you this time?
I think either I remembered more about what I felt about them at the time that had sort of, I think something like In the Bedroom, I had over the years, my opinion on that movie had kind of eroded to, I really like the performances in it. And watching it again, I think I really love the movie as itself. There was a lot of what Todd Field brought to it as a director that I had kind of forgotten. I had sort of allowed it to become the sort of typical Sundance, you know, screenplay plus performances kind of a showcase. And that was, of course, what got nominated for Oscars. So that kind of contributes to that narrative. But I definitely walked away from that being like, oh, yeah, In the Bedroom, I love this movie. And A Beautiful Mind, which is the one I'd seen most recently, which is kind of funny. every time I see that, I go back to watch it again. I'm like, maybe this will be the time I at least will get what other people saw in it. And I just, I find it to be, and I don't want to, like, you know, no offense to anybody who does like it, but, like, I find it to be so awful and so sort of, like, mind-bogglingly so, although not, I don't think I would chalk it up to Jennifer Connelly at all. I don't think she's contributing to the badness. I think she sort of falls victim to it.
She's a victim of circumstance.
Oh, yeah.
As far as A Beautiful Mind, because I couldn't stand it then, and I can't stand it now either.
Yeah.
So I totally hear you.
How about you, Shane? Had you seen any of these recently again, or was this the first rewatch?
Well, I hadn't seen Iris before, but I'd seen the other three about a couple of years after their release when I saw them on Netflix, back when they were more focused on DVDs. But I hadn't remembered much about them, actually. It was interesting to watch them now. I really love In the Bedroom, and was a bit iffy on Iris.
Mm-hmm.
And Gosford Park I found really interesting in terms of how the ensemble worked together and seeing these two performances before, you know, we kind of got sick of Helen Mirren and Maggie Smith phoning it in all the movies. Yeah, it was interesting to watch these again.
I consider myself a huge fan of Robert Altman, and as I was watching Gosford Park again, I was realizing it had been a really, really long time since I had seen a Robert Altman movie, like any of my favorites. And so I had kind of forgotten what it feels like to sit in a room with an Altman movie, because I usually have seen them in circumstances that were less distracting than me watching it on Netflix.
Yeah.
Because they're very immersive experiences, and I had forgotten how much work you have to do.
Yeah, you really have to put everything away.
Yeah, this time I was just like, because I was trying to time, you know, part of the SmackDown is we give you the screen times of the performances, and I was trying to time Helen and Maggie sort of like both at once. And that was so hard to do because the movie has, like, scenes that are so, so short, but they're constantly, characters are constantly coming in and out of frame. So
Right.
And I kept losing track of who was who in the movie because they don't give you any plot. You're just supposed to dive in and figure it out.
Right. Yeah. What's funny with Gosford Park is, so for my podcast, this had Oscar Buzz, we were recording this weekend about the movie Bobby, the Emilio Estevez movie Bobby from 2006. And one of the things we were sort of remarking on that movie was sort of how much it seemed to want to be an Altman movie, in that it had all of these sort of disparate characters in storylines that don't all necessarily touch each other. And it felt very sort of like wanted to be Nashville in a lot of ways. And watching that, I wasn't going to have a positive review of that anyway, but like watching it in the same weekend that I'm also watching Gosford Park for the SmackDown, I'm just like, oh boy, like this is such a stark contrast.
Yeah.
It's so much just like, oh, this is how it's, you know, this is how it's meant to be done. And
yeah,
that was quite something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, ensemble films are like, you know, they're hit or miss, and a lot of times they're missed depending on who's in charge and who's directing and stuff like that. And when I, you know, when I also saw Gosford Park, I had like a similar opinion, especially after I just watched that. I can't even remember the name of the movie. It's so boring and terrible. the one with Kenneth Branagh, and they're on the train. I can't even remember.
Oh, Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, when you have another ensemble film like that, where like everybody's just sort of phoning it in and no one seems to care, or people are like overacting or whatever.
Right.
It's kind of, you know, you need someone like Altman. You need somebody who can step outside of what's going on and sort of direct people to do their job instead of, you know, something like Murder on the Orient Express, where it's kind of like a free for all and it's just names attached and people are just doing whatever they want.
Right.
Yeah.
And Kenneth is probably more concerned with his star performance than the other people in the movie.
Right.
Yeah. Although it is funny watching Gosford Park, I was like, oh yeah, Robert Altman's the star of it. And that's what I forget every time I haven't seen a... Because I was surprised how I had remembered both Maggie and Helen having much bigger roles.
Mm-hmm.
But
I remembered Helen being kind of a she comes on strongly at the end. I remember even at the time that that was a thing where people were just like, you know, wait till that last like 15-20 minutes of the movie, and that's where Mirren really sort of slays you. And she does. She has those two really big scenes with Kelly MacDonald and with Eileen Atkins. Because up until that point, I'm just like, I kept trying to like having to remind myself that like Helen Mirren is playing the head of, you know, all of the servants, and Eileen Atkins is the cook. And I just have to like remind myself which one was which, because their scenes tended to be sort of similar in that they were sort of crabbily sort of sniping at the other ones and telling everybody what to do. And then in that last scene, you find out they're sisters and you find out they have this whole like shared past together. And it's really good. I see why she got nominated in a way that like through most of that movie, I was just like, why did she get nominated? And like, why not Emily Watson? Cause I thought Emily Watson so good in that movie.
Yeah.
And then you like, by the end, I'm just like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, this, like a lot of Altman movies, you kind of feel like they could fill the whole category with this movie because
absolutely.
Kristen Scott Thomas was amazing in it too.
Yep. Totally.
So this is actually my favorite of Helen Mirren's performances.
Nominated or not nominated, like all across the board?
Yeah. Like I don't tend to like she's a very acclaimed performer that I'm a little agnostic on. I don't know if the rest of you are fans, but it's not that I find myself wanting someone else in the part. I just find myself wishing it would go deeper or, you know, like she's very skilled, but I just don't feel it, if that makes sense.
She's a showboater, and I like to watch her showboat when she, you know, gets that kind of role. And I think something like Gosford Park, because the nature of the role is so restrained, she really has to be so contained within herself for so much of the movie that probably helps run counter to, you know, some of those instincts.
Yeah.
You know, Helen Mirren may be at a point. She may be at a point now where it's just like, well, I want to have some fun. And, you know, people try
totally.
To pigeonhole her in these different types of roles where it's all period pieces or she's playing the stuffy grandmother or something.
Right.
Like that. And she's just like, screw it. I want to shoot things up, too. I want to have some fun. And kind of, you know, she's in films and, you know, she's in a new film, a new Luc Besson film called Anna. And I was like, why would she be a part of something like this where she's like sort of totally hamming it up? But I'm like, if she's having fun, then why not?
Yeah, maybe she wants to work with Luc Besson. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's I like that she's, you know, making I feel like I never feel with her that she's not in the career that she wants. I think she's definitely in the career that she wants and good for her.
That is a good point. That's a good point. I should amend what I said. I love her as a celebrity. I'm just not there in terms of, like, if I had to list the dames, like, my ranking of the dames, she would not be high, is what I'm saying.
Boy, that's an article you should be writing immediately, is your ranking of the dames.
Right.
No, I would rank Joan Collins above Helen Mirren just because, I mean, Dynasty is just like that. But, like, you know, I agree that, you know, her career is kind of spotty and not one that I sort of keep on my list.
Yeah.
I'm a big Judi Dench fan, and that's who I watch out for. And, you know, that's one of my favorite dames. So I, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate her, but I find I'm never too surprised by her choices. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm a fan of her, I don't get, like, excited to see how she's going to handle a role. I think she's very reliable, and I appreciate her for that, but I'm never surprised by what she's doing.
Yeah. So before we move on to the other movies, I just have to say, how many of you spent the whole movie thinking about Downton Abbey?
Oh, my God, absolutely.
Especially with Maggie Smith, I mean.
Right.
Well, and so many of the there's so many characters where you're just like, oh, this is where this later Downton Abbey character came from, down to the point where the character who ended up being called Bates in Downton Abbey is played by Alan Bates in Gosford Park. I was just like, wow, Julian Fellowes, you did not stray far from the field at all, did you? Even though it's set in a completely different time. And, you know, the circumstances, the specific sort of historical circumstances are different. But, like, Helen Mirren is very much Mrs. Hughes. And, you know, the difference, I thought that was interesting with Maggie Smith in that, like, Maggie Smith's character in Downton Abbey is a lot more sort of not necessarily in control, but like she's elevated a little bit above. In this movie, it's interesting to see her dependent on Michael Gambon's character for like her allowance or whatever. I think it gives her a little bit another angle to play that maybe she didn't have in Downton Abbey. And I don't think she's bad in Downton Abbey. I just think as the seasons wore on, she became kind of a catchphrase machine, which was kind of funny for that kind of a show.
Yeah.
but she gets some angles to do here. I like the scenes where it's her and Kelly MacDonald sort of like getting ready or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you see her kind of strategizing and finding ways that she can keep and hold on to, you know, this little piece of, you know, wealth that she has from her family that she has to like hold on to. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I was actually surprised because I went into this viewing again thinking, I know this is might feel like a warm up to Downton Abbey because it's written by the same guy. But at least Maggie Smith will be the same character because I didn't remember the movie well, and I was very wrong. She's really not the Dowager Countess in this.
Yeah, a lot of other characters are much more have much more close relationship to later characters in Downton.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she's a little bit different.
Even fresh Oscar-nominated Richard E. Grant is kind of like the bitchy
the bitchy gay guy? Yeah, yeah, for sure.
The bitchy footman, is that what they call him?
Yes, I think that's right.
Well,
did anybody else watch Downton Abbey? Were you guys thinking that as well, or were you not familiar?
I waited. I'm one of those people who waits until it's over and then binge.
Yeah, so that's my list.
Game of Thrones is over, and I'm about to watch that now. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen Downton Abbey, but I feel like Maggie Smith's character has been like such a pop culture like phenomenon that I've like seen memes and like
sure.
So yeah. I feel I know her character even though I've never seen a single episode of Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hi there, I'm here.
Oh, Eric, hello.
You made it.
Oh my God.
We have our late panelists entering. Eric, we've been talking about Gosford Park this whole time.
Okay, good, because it's worth talking about for the whole time.
So before we move on to the other movies, we want to know who was your favorite performance in Gosford Park, because we had different reactions.
Yeah, my favorite performance in Gosford Park? That's kind of tough, but I really, really love Emily Watson.
Yeah, she was my takeaway this time. I didn't remember her in it.
Yeah.
She was my takeaway, too. I think more than anybody, I got more from her.
She even sells that moment that's the most, like, scripted in the movie.
Where the outburst at dinner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
the thing that's hardest to sell without seeming like, oh, that's a screenplay device, you know?
Right, right. Well, and it's interesting because it allows her character to kind of shift in the way that we see her, because we're seeing her mostly through Kelly MacDonald, through her interactions with Kelly MacDonald, and she starts out being the person who's going to sort of like show her the ropes, and then after that she becomes this somewhat mysterious figure of like, what else do we not know about you? What are you, you know, what secrets are you hiding? That kind of thing. And then that becomes the thing about the whole house, is just like, what secrets are wait a second, what's going on with everybody? And then the second half of the movie becomes, you know, we find out about Ryan Phillippe, we find out about Clive Owen, we find out about, you know, Helen Mirren and Eileen Atkins being related to each other and all of this stuff. And I think that's sort of the unlocking moment, and that's what I kind of like about, I'll allow a scripty moment like that if it, you know, turns the movie that way.
Yeah. Oh, I'll always allow a scripty moment like that, a dramatic something in the middle of a giant dinner party. I'm here for that every time.
Screeches it to a halt. Yeah, for sure.
I'm like, this is what I want to do at Christmas.
I loved watching the smirks around the table too, about people just being like, "Oh, this is delicious!" Like
Richard E. Grant, thank you.
Yes. Oh my God, for sure.
The only way that it would have gotten elevated is if it turned into an actual food fight. Like, I just, you know, if it turned into a food fight, then it'd have been like, okay, well, now this is like going overboard. But, you know, we live for those moments.
Yeah.
It's scripted, but they're always a ton of fun if they're written properly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember watching this time. I felt like it was a lot less stuffy than I remembered. Like, it's a really funny film, and mm-hmm. I really appreciated how it wasn't as, you know, stuffy and dramatic, and, you know, I thought it was really interesting, the tone of the film.
Yeah. I like little things like how they all had Ryan Phillippe's fake accent pegs from, like, the beginning, which is, like, kind of fun for us. It was just like, oh, right, like, we don't have to pretend that, like, everybody else is kind of dumb. Like, you know what I mean? They get it. That's fine.
That was almost kind of like a meta moment where, as a cinephile, when you watch a movie and you can, you know, clock a really bad accent, it was exactly that for me, and that just cracks me up every time I see the movie.
I have a friend who is very much just like, and any time I'll talk about a performance, they'll just be like, yeah, but their accent is awful. And I'd be like, I didn't even know they were doing an accent. I don't know how you can call that. And so, like, that reminded me of that, of just sort of like people just being like, oh, his accent's terrible.
Yes.
Well, this is when I lose all my points and no one will ever trust me on the accent work again. I had forgotten that he was an actor playing a part in the first half of the movie.
Oh, and you just thought he was an actual servant with
a Scottish
accent.
I forgot that Ryan Phillippe was playing a Scotsman in this movie. And then all of a sudden, everybody was talking about, like, or Kelly MacDonald's reaction to him is so funny. Not from any part of Scotland, I know.
Yeah,
exactly. That's kind of great, though, that your revisit on this was that fresh. I think that's fantastic.
Listen, I love the movie, but I think I watched it a lot in the, like, around the time it came out, because I was a huge fan of it, but I have not seen it in, like, at least 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
So I had forgotten a lot. And also I have a bad memory, so. But that's why movies can feel fresh to me again.
Yeah.
Well, since we were talking about Downton Abbey so much, I just have to segue to Iris because Lord Grantham.
Yes. Yeah, we were getting
a full Downton treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also losing your memory. So that's a perfect segue. You're Judy Dench right now.
Yeah.
Oh, and who wouldn't want to be Judi Dench? She's so good in this movie. She's like, that's my takeaway. For as much as I know what I was watching for, you know, to form my opinion on Kate Winslet in the movie, it's tough not to walk away just foregrounding Judi Dench.
Yeah, agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, I don't know. I can't remember what happened that year, but it was one of her better performances. Like, Judi Dench is always good. Good. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got that down. But she was, like, good in this. And did she get a nomination? I can't remember.
She did,
I'm looking it up now.
Yeah.
Okay, and she just, I don't know. Because, you know, I'm still hung up on the Shakespeare in Love Award, and I still was like, wow. It's a good performance, but it's not. You know, you want people to be rewarded for some of their best work, and that was unfortunate. Even though I noticed about Kate Winslet, who is great in the movie as well, but I don't know. I felt like Judi Dench, she's not in the movie, like, you know, her and Kate sort of split time somewhat easily. But I don't know. I just remember liking Judi Dench's performance a lot more because it was something so different. Now she's, you know, Judi Dench is in these roles where she plays, like, the old traveler, or she's a, you know, an old woman with the secret or whatever. But this was something that was really different. And I appreciate it.
That was a really strong Best Actress year. It's funny because, like, I don't ever remember her even being kind of a threat to win. And it's mostly just because Sissy Spacek and Halle Berry and Nicole Kidman were taking up a lot of the oxygen of that conversation.
They were, kind
of rightly.
Rightly so. They were also good.
And Renee had such a huge hit.
So, right, yeah.
So it was
that's
almost
strong,
like Judy was fifth.
This rewatching of Iris for me was really something, because even though I was supposed to be really focused on Kate Winslet, and I really, really loved her in this, my father-in-law died of Alzheimer's like 3 years ago. So watching Judi Dench's performance had a very different impact on me, and it made it, I guess, a better performance. Mm-hmm. Just my personal experience with it became very much a part of what I was watching.
Yeah.
Which changed. I mean, it's so weird. Like we were just saying a minute ago, that rewatching something with different experiences and different knowledge is such a completely different experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I
remember crying. I think I cried like, toward the end. I was in boohoo tears because it was a touching thing, and I can imagine that anybody that has experienced that or gone through that or has a relative that's aging and dementia, that it would be a film that would hit close to home, you know?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of films should do that. They should find a way. I mean, I'm not saying I expect like Resident Evil to hit close to home. That's not what I'm saying. films like that should have an impact, and they hopefully will be able to touch people personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was at the time. I remember in 2001, I was like very obsessed with Kate Winslet in this. Like I actually, you know, I was already giving out awards each year. That's around the time I started, and and Kate Winslet took my gold medal. And so I'm watching the performance, thinking of how obsessed with it I was, and now. And this time through, I was like, oh, yeah, it's a Kate Winslet performance. Like, the time has, like, because I think at the time I had to put myself back in that headspace to try to figure out why I was so obsessed with it. And I think it was because she was still such, like, a fresh, exciting movie star at the time.
Yeah.
And she had such life force on screen when she was young. And this role is all about being that sort of, you know, it's almost like an elemental figure, you know. Mm-hmm. She's like this completely liberated, like, free thinker.
Right.
And it was just, it was reminding me of how exciting and how pure I thought her face was for the camera early on in her career. So it was fun to revisit this. Like, I don't think it's one of her best performances now, but I still loved her in it.
It's an era of her career that feels like this role was really capitalizing on what she was, what she kind of represented as an actress. Between this, I think of this and Holy Smoke and, to an extent, Quills, because Quills is playing on that idea that, like, it's all this, like, repressedness that, like, he's trying to draw out of her and, like, you always feel like she's just sort of like almost like a time bomb ready to go off in Quills a little bit. And it's this kind of character that's going to come out, this kind of, you know, uninhibited and almost a little bit dangerous kind of a young woman. And Iris really capitalized. That's sort of all that it asks her to do. I kind of wish the movie would ask her to do a little bit more, because I think she's certainly capable of it. But I think what it's asking her to do, she's like, I think she can kind of do it with, you know, her eyes closed.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't to say that I think that she's phoning it in this, but I just feel like this is definitely her wheelhouse.
Yeah.
I think it is one of her better performances, but again, this is a retrospective. And I think for me, one of the reasons why I like it so much is because this was an era before she really became very self-aware of herself as an actress. And, and I mean, anything for me post The Reader or even right before The Reader, I haven't liked as much. I feel like she's a different person and her motivations seem different. And this was just like a, so like loose and raw and open and free. And I love this era of Kate Winslet.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Yeah. And I think she sells like sexual liberation better than a lot of actors do. Mm-hmm. Not that a lot of actors are called on to sell that, since we have a lot
But I think a lot of that has to do with Kate being sort of comfortable in her own body now.
Yeah.
You know, she was one of the first people to sort of promote body positivity.
Yeah, that's true.
That I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that has to do with her level of comfort with herself personally, as opposed to, like, what does Hollywood think of me?
Yeah.
So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I had totally forgotten about that. Thanks. Yeah, you're totally right, Valerie. It was, like, as I remember, at the time, in the late 90s, like, people were very, very hard on actresses who weren't size zeros.
Yeah.
And I remember her getting lots of flack for her dress for the Titanic Oscars.
Which she looks gorgeous in.
Gorgeous, but people thought she looked a little heavy or something.
Right,
so she
was
getting all this bad publicity.
I even remember hearing, and this might be apocryphal because people just have things to say about James Cameron, but, like, I remember there being stuff about, like, Cameron giving her problems on while filming Titanic about her being, whatever, something about her weight.
Too curvy.
Yeah, something. I don't know. Yeah. Just sort of, like, jabbing at her or something like that. And I don't know. Believe it or don't believe it. But if you're inclined to feel negatively about James Cameron, I guess you believe it.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's very good in the movie. There's something limited, I think, about the whole movie that I can't quite put my finger on. That, like, I admire what it's doing, but I don't really ever... I never really latched onto it in a way that I was sort of hoping to.
Mm-hmm. I think it might be because one of its greatest strengths is also one of its greatest weaknesses, and that's the cutting back and forth between the time periods. There are times when it feels really, really amazing. Like, you know, Hugh Bonneville looking, through a crack in the door, but it's Judi Dench on the other side. And there are times when the impact of it's really great. And then there's other times when doing it lessens the impact of the period that you're really kind of supposed to be watching.
Yeah.
But that said, I think this is probably the best example of younger, older casting of the same character that I've ever seen. Ever.
With Broadbent and Bonneville?
Oh my God!
It's really, really amazing. Yeah,
all four of them, but especially those two. It's frightening.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a very well cast movie. I remember thinking that while I was watching it. They really did good with this casting.
Yeah, like I didn't know who Hugh Bonneville was at the time that Iris came out, and I remember wondering if he was related to Jim Broadbent. So. Just a quick thing I just wanted to say about Jim Broadbent in this. Like, he won the Oscar for Iris. And I had
remembered... No, he won it for Moulin Rouge.
Right. And I had remembered that he was amazing in Iris. And this time through, I was kind of annoyed with him. Like, I thought he was doing too much, whereas I thought Judy and Kate were perfect at what they were asked to do. And then I was just remembering how he's so genius in Moulin Rouge by doing too much. So it's like this weird, I realized he won because he was having an amazing year, but still, I wish it had been for Moulin Rouge.
That's an interesting Oscar win because it's that he ends up winning for the movie that isn't a Best Picture nominee, even though he's so good in the one that is a Best Picture nominee. Yeah. You would think that logic would dictate that, like, oh, the voters seem to really like Moulin Rouge, certainly better than Iris, because Iris didn't get a Best Picture nomination. So, like, it's almost like the transitive property is just like, well, because of that, you would maybe love Jim Broadbent best in Moulin Rouge. But I think there's something about his performance in Moulin Rouge that touches the grotesque in a way that it's supposed to, in a way that I think works. But I think some people sort of see that and are just like, it's like, I have to back away. I have to go to the safe ground of the caring husband to sort of, feel sane again. I'm like, I get it.
Yeah, the loving or the long-suffering spouse, only this time it's a man instead of a woman.
Right.
So it was unusual in that way.
Right.
I was going to touch on something that was said earlier about when limitations were mentioned, and I think a lot of that has to do with the story, or maybe not even the story, but just the plot and sort of the way it's edited and told. Because I felt like every time I really got down with what was happening, the era and the time would change. And it was like, well, okay. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go, then it'd be that again, where it's like we're in modern times and we're sinking into Iris's illness and everything. And then we're back in the past. And it's like I couldn't, it's not that I couldn't keep up. It was a hard time for me to continue to be connected and in tune with what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that is an accurate assessment when we say that it was limiting. It just, but I think it was limited by its own editing and the way it told story.
That also aligns with what you were saying, Eric. That it's like it's hit and miss qualities. Its best qualities are also its worst qualities. like I love how brief the movie is. I had forgotten that it clocks right in like 90 minutes.
Oh God, yeah, it's so short.
Yeah, and I always appreciate when movies can just tell their story and roll credits, you know. but there were a lot of times where I felt like I was wanting more from it, which
yeah.
not just from each era, but like more from the scenes. Like I wanted them to play a little longer or something.
Yeah.
No, it could have benefited from another 30 minutes, and I can't believe I'm saying that, but it could have benefited from it could have been a full two-hour length movie, and I'd have been like, okay, well, I'm satisfied. I got all that I can get out of it in 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
You know, now most movies are 3 and 4 hours, so yes. So Iris is a blessing.
Yeah.
Iris Part 1 is this summer, and then Iris Part 2 comes next summer, so get ready.
Actually, can you imagine if they had done, you know, a section that was only, you know, Bonneville and Winslet, and then a section that was only Broadbent
right.
and Gens? That'd be kind of fun.
Groundbreaking.
But really, maybe more as a limited series.
Because it's a Richard Eyre movie, and with Judi Dench, Eyre, however we pronounce that name, it makes me feel like I want to see, I would have loved to have seen what Kate Winslet could have done in Notes on a Scandal. In not that I don't love Kate Blanchett in Notes on a Scandal.
Yeah.
But like imagining like those two, her and Dench, playing those roles opposite each other kind of flipped me out.
Yeah. Well, Notes on a Scandal, that's one I'd take a two-parter on. Give me 2 more hours of that.
Oh, my God. Notes on a Scandal, Infinity War, and then Notes on a Scandal.
Endgame. Yep. Yes.
Totally into that.
That's friendly.
Yeah. I want all of it. I want 2 Notes, 2 Scandal.
Oh, and
I want You're Not Young Part 2.
Don't worry. And then in Endgame, we can get all the crazies together. We can get Greta, and we can get
Ma.
Who else?
Ma.
We can get Ma. We can have that scene on the battlefield where they go and terrorize everybody else.
What
yes,
was that Adam
great.
Boyan movie with Amanda Seyfried and Julianne Moore?
Yes,
Chloe.
Oh my God!
That's true. That's what the Captain Marvel scene in this movie is. It's just like all of the crazies assembling together, coming at your ass. Like
oh
it'll
my
be.
God.
Wow! Now I'm going to be thinking about this imaginary franchise for the rest of the day.
Exactly.
In the bedroom, we're saving A Beautiful Mind till last. Obviously.
Great.
In the bedroom, we did talk about this a little bit at the beginning of the conversation. I'm not sure I have a lot to say about it. I think it's a strong movie, and I think the direction is, oddly considering Oscar history, one of its biggest strengths, and the director was, of course, not nominated.
Yeah. Boy, that was the trend that year, though, because also Baz Luhrmann wasn't nominated.
Yeah.
For the most directory movie of that, like, with the possible exception of Peter Jackson, like, that was the most director-forward movie. And, like, I always get sort of that hacky joke of, like, I guess the movie directed itself that an Oscar host will always make about the movie that doesn't get the director nomination. But in this case, I was just like, Jesus Christ, like, you know, I loved Mulholland Drive, too, trust me. And, like, but we couldn't have knocked off something else? Couldn't have, I don't know.
I think Ridley
Still
Scott.
Still annoyed it up.
Cause this was
yeah,
a,
Ridley Scott.
Because this
right?
was a 3-5 year at the Oscars. Right. Like, there were only 3 Best Pictures nominated for director.
Right, right. Was David Lynch's nomination for Mulholland Drive the only nomination that movie got?
It was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. Mm. I mean, not, like, I love that movie, so like I'm not going to complain about it, but like that's wild.
Yeah.
I have such a love-hate relationship with Lone Director nominations. I love them because so often they are such a deserved nomination.
Right.
But then it just shows how basic the rest of the branches can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also what tends to happen with them, I think, I don't have the research to back this up, but in my head, this is what happens, is that the Lone Director nomination is usually deserving, but the person they knock out is not the one they should have knocked out.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
In this case, it's the person that won.
That won, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Cough, Ron Howard, cough.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
No, but I'm curious to see what everybody else, to hear what everybody else thought about In the Bedroom, because I, like, really, like, even more so flipped for it this time.
I did, too.
Yeah. I adore it. It's just amazing to me.
I think In the Bedroom is a fine movie. Not that I don't like it, because I do. But I feel, I don't know, it reminded me of something I would see on stage, like a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's very, you know, the sets are very, very limited and the direction is like, you know, there's not a lot going on, but it's the simplicity of the direction that makes the film so great.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say fine in terms of like, I don't mean like, oh, it was boring or unexciting. I don't know. There's something about the subtlety of the way it's directed and the performances are what carry the film.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I wonder, like, when you have performances that carry a film, does the director deserve a nomination? Like, I don't know. I'm putting that out there to the gallery to see what you guys think.
I tend to view it as, like, these movies that are actors' movies, so to speak. When all the performances are operating at a really, really high level, as I think is the case within The Bedroom, like, I think even Nick Stahl's great in it. Yeah, I think you have to give props to the director when it's very, like, cohesive in terms of the elevated quality of the acting. That's my take on that.
Same here, and I think when the material is as good as it is and the performances are as well, I think a director that can stand back and allow that to happen and not turn it into some kind of weird vehicle for themselves is an outstanding director.
Yeah. What, speaking of, what happened to him?
Oh, you mean like David O. Russell, who turns it into a vehicle for himself. he's a perfect example of that, David O. Russell. I just want to throw that out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I found the underlying dread in this rewatch so much more palpable than I remember in the first time. And it wasn't because I knew what was going to happen, but it was because I got to kind of focus on other things. And it is a very static and cold movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got really into that part of it. And it just wasn't how I remembered before. So I found it much more involving this time. And for Tomei, I forgot how little she actually has in this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a tiny role, and she doesn't, you know, after he's dead, she doesn't really have any type of B-plot or subplot to her own at all.
No.
Right. She shows up for two scenes. She sees him again. She sees Matt again, and she sees Ruth again.
That's one time,
kind of a piece.
She feels like a lead at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
Because she's in the like
first
the first 20
see,
minutes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
She has the first line and everything. But then
as soon as he's
dead, she's barely in it. Shane, I feel like you've been very quiet. Want to hear from Shane on this movie.
I was going to say, like, that feeling of dread, I feel like Marissa Tomei brings a lot of that in the first part of the movie. I think especially that scene where she's talking with is it Nick Stahl?
Yeah.
About his future, and he's like, oh, I'm going to delay going to school. And I feel like she gives him this look that is, like, so regretful, and, like, she knows something bad is going to happen. It's like she's regretful for getting him this situation. I think she does so much, even though she's not in the movie that much. She's bringing a lot of the dread that Eric was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she knows so much more than she's ever saying in those scenes. Yeah. Yeah. I also feel like she brings a lot of, I think she's very aware of how his parents see her. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think she carries a lot of sort of like guilt with that. Like whenever you see her around Sissy Spacek, especially mm-hmm. In those early scenes, you can tell she knows what kind of, you know, threat she brings to Frank's life. I don't think she knows she's bringing like mortal threat, but right. I think she's threatening to like derail his, you know, his path a little bit.
The golden child of this couple. Yeah.
Right. And so I think she knows that Ruth doesn't like her. And so she brings a lot of that into her scenes with her. There's a lot of sort of apologizing for herself without like saying it, but with her body language and with her face and everything like that. She just does a lot.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think she's great in this.
Everything that's going on.
Me too.
I think she's phenomenal. Yeah.
And she is.
And it's also, it also reminded me, because I feel like we need reminders with Marissa Tomei, who's one of, usually people with three nominations are not underappreciated actors, but in her case,
right.
I think she is.
Yeah.
And all three of her nominations are great performances, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. Usually with that many, even when you get into as many as three nominations, there's usually one that you can be like, all right. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You didn't need that one.
That
but I think
generous.
She's great.
Yeah.
Right, she's great in all three of her nominations.
Yeah.
I wanted to say I really like the surprise of, because you think, you walk into the film thinking that it's about her, but I like the surprise that it's not about her, but it's about this couple, and mm-hmm. it's about grief and loss and revenge, mm-hmm. which is another surprise. So
right.
I liked that sort of switcheroo, and I mean, you know, I get it. They put people at the front for marketing purposes because at that time, Marissa Tomei may have been the most, not the most famous, but just the most remembered at the time. But
yeah, this
I think
was kind of
I like
back for Sissy. Yeah.
Right. Right.
The structure of the movie is really interesting in that it's essentially three movies and
mm-hmm.
the one that leads up to Frank getting killed. And then that middle part, which is just about Ruth and Matt kind of at war with each other, and
right.
then the third part that's about Matt carrying out this sort of final thing, and they all kind of communicate stuff about the family and about the like small town
yeah.
kind of environment that they're in.
What the thing that stood out for me this time that I don't know if I caught this, I don't really remember the, you know, 2001, how I was feeling in this regard, but I thought it surprised me how much sexuality is like text in this movie.
Yeah.
Like everything is kind of about the sexual relations. Not,
even
just,
in, like,
not
the first,
just the young couple, but the main couple.
Yeah.
Well, you see in that first part where like anytime they're approaching kind of an argument or a disagreement about Frank, he'll sort of start coming on to her. Tom Wilkinson
yeah.
will start coming on to her as a way of like diffusing the tension.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes not really available to them in the middle part. So they have to really just like stewing. And you're right that the title In the Bedroom really, you know, becomes more into focus
mm-hmm.
because of that stuff.
And I think the final third, it works in this really mysterious way about being about the marriage too.
Yeah.
That he's going to, I think he's carrying it out more for her than for himself.
Yes, absolutely.
To like the marriage, yeah.
Yeah, to save the marriage. So it's like, I think it's a really interesting movie. Like,
yeah.
I hadn't seen it since 2001, I think. And
yeah.
I would watch it again next week.
Yeah.
mm-hmm.
So.
And it was the first Sundance movie to crack Best Picture, right? That was its sort of legacy. The first movie, I think, that was in competition
that.
At Sundance. I remember that being like a thing, because I remember at the time people were like, don't get your hopes up for In the Bedroom. It's a Sundance movie. You know, these Sundance movies never get that, you know, make it that far.
It was also a debut, so that probably also contributed to why we didn't expect it to.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. And speaking of that, what has happened to Todd Field?
I don't know, but I need him to make another movie. It feels like every once in a while I'll hear about a new movie he's developing, and then it'll just sort of go away.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, when was
he was working
movie
on a Bo Bergdahl movie for a while, and I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't know. Every once in a while, it feels like there's like an article that he's adapting, and it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. When was the last movie he made?
Little Children.
Yeah.
Wow. That was like 13 years ago or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he has 4 upcoming projects, but everything's like in various stages of development.
Yeah, it's all that like announced or whatever that IMDb will say, and it's
exactly.
Just like, oh, announced is such a tease. Like, yeah,
yeah.
Do you think he fit in our current climate? Like, I feel like he'd be more on like Netflix or like a limited series. Like his style and this kind of movie. I don't know how it fits in today's climate for films.
These kind of movies are super struggling right now.
Yeah.
These like mid-level and mid-adult dramas are struggling, and that's why Amazon and Netflix have been able to completely take the reins of that and do a little bit more, because there's just not a lot of studios that are trusting these movies.
Even A24 seems to have given up on that.
A bit, yeah.
And it sucks because these are the movies that are most impactful to me. They're the ones with the most to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the acting is usually top notch.
Yeah.
So now they're just sort of giving up. And it really sucks. Because without Amazon and Hulu and Netflix or whatever, who don't always promote these things, by
right,
the way.
Right.
They don't always promote these things well. What will people like us do? Like, you know, I love Endgame and everything, but, you know, and Child's Play and stuff, but I can't, you know, I live in New York City. Tickets are $15. I need to get more out of film.
Yeah.
I need to get more out of that.
Which is so funny, because I think that's what the root of the problem is people think that they need more, but they mean it in a different way than you're meaning it.
Yeah.
Right.
So they think, oh, I have to, if I pay money, I have to get a spectacle.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which is forgetting that a lot of people, like when they talk about their favorite movies or whatever, I mean, this might not be as much the case now, but even if you go back 10, 20 years, people will name like famous dramas, you know, as like their favorite movie. And I'm like, do you support anything like that in the theater now, even though you say it's your favorite?
And it's not all about spectacle. It's about filmmaking and acting and storytelling, and I like that. But God, I mean, there's only so much I can talk about. There's only so much discourse we can have around an explosion.
The dirty little secret about all this is that, like, the best film diet is a mix of everything.
Yeah,
and the balance is like totally off now.
I think it's good that we're living in a time where we can get things like Roma and Mad Max nominated for Best Picture. You know, but I think, you know, it's like you said, finding that balance. And now that social media is in play and the Academy is trying to shift based on what they see on social media, I think they are older people who are not, and I'm not trying to be ageist or anything. I'm just saying they may be out of touch with things. So they may think they want to give us what we want, and they don't know how to integrate that into decade, you know, year-old system. I don't know if that makes sense.
But those old people figured out how to use the online voting system and voted for Green Book. somebody's been taking like a senior center tutorial or something.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like,
and they all came out in force to vote for A Beautiful Mind in 2001. We need to take it back for our final part of our conversation. I'm shocked to tell you this. I knew it at the time. I'm still shocked about it today. A Beautiful Mind made like $170 million, something crazy.
So much
like
money.
Yep. It was such a huge hit.
And I don't understand.
Yeah, and like, it seems like something that would come out today would make $20 million or something.
Not even.
And
it wouldn't make that. It would not make that.
Although it does have like, you know, like the pyrotech car chases, like, you know, trying to appeal to everybody at all times, which is one of the reasons I think it's a bad movie.
It also was like Russell Crowe at his like apex, the most America ever liked him.
Yeah.
Was like that
right
moment.
And Ron Howard.
He was riding high. I feel like he was riding high on Gladiator still, on Gladiator fame at that time.
For sure.
Yeah. And back when we went to movies for the stars, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I will say that I remember hating this movie at the time. And so, like, when I went back, when I went back to rewatch this time, I was like, I'm going to give this movie a fair shake. And for the first, like, 10 minutes, I was just like, oh, this isn't as bad as I remembered it.
Yeah.
And then it became as bad as I remembered it.
Yeah. It is.
Think about how short Iris is. Why is A Beautiful Mind this long?
Yeah.
Good. especially when half of it is completely fictional.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I had forgotten that they take like half the movie to reveal to you that they've been lying to you the whole, it's like one of those, it was all a dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's
Jennifer Connelly.
But I will say this, she was better than I remembered her being. Because I was so annoyed she won the Oscar. I still think it's the least deserving of the five nominated performances, but she was better than I remembered.
It's weird that she steamrolled as much as she did. That there was, like, I guess she didn't through the Critics Awards portion of the year, but like, there was never any question who was winning the Oscar that year. Yeah. And that sort of frustrated me.
The anomaly was SAG, and that's only because they put her in lead at SAG.
They put her in lead.
So Helen Mirren won, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
As the only other, because the other nominees at SAG that year were all not nominated for Oscar. It was, it was like Dakota Fanning for I Am Sam and Cate Blanchett for Bandits.
Yeah.
And Cameron Diaz for Vanilla Sky, maybe.
Yeah.
And Judy Dench.
Yeah.
For The Shipping News.
It was just
for The Shipping News.
That was bizarre. That was so bizarre.
Yeah. What a strange movie. But I would say that it was unfortunate. I wasn't really too pleased with her winning the Oscar that year either, especially since she gave the bomb-ass Requiem for a Dream performance that was like the year before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was one of those cases where it's like, this actress has done so much better, and this is what you get her. I mean, she's good in the film, don't get me wrong. She's probably one of the film's saving graces, but
yeah.
I was disappointed that she was able to sweep.
Yeah.
So was this one of those like breakthrough ingenue wins? Because I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, she'd been famous for quite a while at this point, but she wasn't like A-list.
Mm.
And I think people were sort of patiently waiting for when that breakthrough was going to happen because I remember her being in a movie like, do you remember that movie Mulholland Falls? Not Mulholland Drive, but Mulholland Falls with like Nick Nolte and whatever. And it was like all the gangsters and she was, I think, the most prominent of the women in that cast, which is probably not saying very much because it's a very much like a male gangster movie. Mm-hmm. But she was in like Dark City and all these sort of movies that felt like they were leveling her up from like teen star because she was in like Labyrinth and whatnot. Right. And then Requiem felt like the big leap up. But of course, like, you know, even with nominating Ellen Burstyn, nominating Jennifer Connelly for like what she endures in that movie, I think was probably another one of those like too much. We can't look this in the face.
Yeah.
So we'll wait for the next year when it's like a much more palatable thing. Yeah. And then her career just falls off a cliff after A Beautiful Mind, which is so sad and so disappointing.
Yeah.
But don't you think
Is it by choice though?
Because I feel like she wouldn't be without offers.
I think she just kept taking bad ones. I think she kept taking this series of, like, really bad roles.
Yeah, because the thing is
she
had trouble having hits after that. Because she had leading roles, but, like, nothing took, really. When she had leads, it was always either the man was more central, like something like The Rocketeer, where a lot of people remember her from. Because I think that was her first adult romantic lead, maybe. Or at least a higher profile one. Mm-hmm. And then things like that. She had that thriller, Dark something.
Dark Water.
Dark Water,
Moving to Roosevelt Island.
Oh, God!
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Have you lived in Roosevelt Island? It is scary.
I have friends who moved to Roosevelt Island, and I mention that movie to them once a week. I generally just, like, watch out. Something's in your basement.
She was in Hulk too. That was a pretty high profile movie.
Yeah.
But that was that was such a disappointment. People really resented that movie.
Yeah, they did.
It was, but that's exactly the kind of movie that an ingenue supporting actress gets right after they win.
Yes.
It's like, all right, we're going to vault you to superstar of now, and now you're at this level.
And it almost never worked.
The movie was so poorly received.
Yeah. Guys, I think we're forgetting the big win of her life, though. She is married to Paul Bettany.
She is. That's true.
Because of this movie.
Right, because
that's right. No, they met on set.
Yes.
So
only she could see him.
Yeah. Oh, but we should talk about her performance a little bit. I do think that even though I think she's better in it than I remembered her, I do think it's kind of like three different performances. That don't
She seems like a different person as a student than as his like wife, and then that sort of like beatific sort of late older age.
Well, yeah, because the first act that she's in the movie, I think she's actually bad in when she's playing the sort of like flirtatious student.
Yep.
Because I was like, what is going on with this movie? I
liked her forthrightness when she marched up to that window and throws it open and asks those construction workers to please move somewhere else for a while. I don't know. I like that.
But she
talk about scripted moments.
Yeah,
though.
She never ever feels like a real person, I think, until they're married and she has to deal with his schizophrenia. And then I think the performance is good, but only for the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
I think she is barely okay. she goes from from beige paint to like beige wallpaper.
Didn't
y'all
she wear a beige dress to the
on this
Oscars
movie
as well?
I hate this movie. I hated it actually even more in this rewatch, and it's a big part of it wasn't even the performances. It's James Horner's unbelievably bombastic score.
And I love James Horner, but oh my God, it's so grating.
It's the worst. No. But he also did the score for Iris the same year, which is not as obviously explosive as this, but it's also look at me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. His scores are so identifiable where if you ever hear anything that either reminds you of Titanic or Field of Dreams, it's just like, that's a James Horner score. Like, he borrows from himself a lot in ways that I think are often very effective, but in this...
Yeah, Thomas Newman did the same thing for, like, two decades.
Yeah,
Yep, there he is.
They all do that. Listen.
Yeah. But anyway...
How did you guys feel about the direction? I'm just not a huge fan of Ron Howard.
There's a lot of it.
Boring.
Listen, I think the perfect description of this movie, I think, was given by our friend Nick Davis. We were talking about it once for a different project. I think it was about Best Pictures. And he called it a crisis of direction. Because the movie keeps changing what it's trying to do and what it is. And not in an elegant way. Shape-shifting way. So
maybe that was just the directorial version of schizophrenia.
Well, it does at very many times. It almost flirts with the idea that schizophrenia is like magic. Like it's this sort of like wonderful magic thing for you.
Oh, and from our modern perspective too, when people become far more sensitive about like mental health, thank God.
Yeah.
This movie is kind of dangerous. It's like, just
super.
Think the problem away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also think, too, the casting of Jennifer Connelly in a role that is a Central American woman would have not passed muster now.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even realize that.
Well, the whole formation of the role wouldn't... It's like, so you have this woman who finally becomes a character with some agency once she gets married. I mean, that's actually terrible.
Oh, it's the epitome of the supporting wife performance and role.
And it's a trope that the whole film is really dangerous, and that's why I really don't particularly care for it. To be honest, when I rewatched it, I didn't get through it because I was like, I have better things to do. I'm going to go use the bathroom. I'm going to do whatever. I just was like... Because I just was like, well, I, you know, but it was just, you know, it was just a lot. It made like you guys were saying, it just made schizophrenia seem like this whimsical adventure. Like, oh, you can dream up anything, and oh, you're a genius. Like, the mad genius thing is so tiring. And it's like, yeah. It's, you know, mm-hmm. we get it. It's there, but I don't know. Whatever. Jennifer Connelly, she's a good actress. She's just a victim here. I don't know.
Yeah, so it sounds like thumbs down all around on A Beautiful Mind. Listen, everyone, thank you so much. We have to wrap up. So a final question, because we always do this. If you had to switch the roles around, give me one example of one of these five women you would have liked to see in one of the other roles. And just out of curiosity, who do you think would have brought something interesting to one of the other roles?
Marissa Tomei in A Beautiful Mind would have been great.
I was about to say Jennifer Connelly in the bedroom.
that would have been an interesting interesting swap for sure. I almost want to see Jennifer Connelly as in the old age makeup in Gosford Park, the Maggie Smith character.
Wait, can she use the same makeup she used in A Beautiful
yes.
Mind?
Oh, okay. She has to. That's part of the challenge. Yeah,
it is. Oh my God, that's brilliant.
I would like terrible. To see Maggie Smith in the Helen Mirren role, because I would love to see Maggie
yeah.
Smith do something super restrained.
Yes, please.
Yeah, totally.
Because I'm wondering how much fire she could bring out without bringing it, if you know what I mean.
And honestly, yeah. I think Helen Mirren could have killed the Kate Winslet younger role in Iris as well. Like, Helen Mirren still got it. She can bring it in that role.
I think it'd be interesting to see Kate Winslet in the Helen Mirren type of role. I wonder how she would do that one.
The maid with secrets.
Isn't yeah. that where her career is going right now?
Oh, dang.
No, I mean like Steve Jobs. Like, it's more like. Like,
oh my God, I hate her in Steve Jobs.
Well, so
I
we can
love her in Steve Jobs.
Fix it, Steve.
We can get Kate Winslet and Jennifer Connelly to do, instead of calling it Gosford Park, we can call it Prospect Park, and make it take place in Brooklyn and update it and have one person live on one floor and one person live on the other floor of the brownstone. And
I'm pretty sure that's where they live, too. I'm pretty sure her and Bethany.
I think we can make that happen.
Valerie, I want you to write the screenplay.
Oh, I like that.
Well, thank you so much for everybody for discussing 2001 with us. We would love to hear from listeners your feelings about this year and about this conversation. Continue it in the comments, please. And once again, I want to thank my guests, SmackDown regular Joe Reed.
Thanks. Bye.
Returning SmackDowner Eric Anderson. Thanks for joining us last second.
Yes, I did. I was gay late. Sorry.
Well, it's Gay Pride Month, so you're excused.
Yes.
And two people who joining us for the first time, who we'd love to have back, Valerie Complex.
Holla back.
And Shane Slater. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having me.